Welcome to the Audio Renaissance presentation of Edgar Casey, An American Prophet. Written by Sidney D. Kirkpatrick. Adapted for audio by Brenda Scott Royce. Produced by John Baker. Final production supervised by Jill Whitesides. And read by William David Griffith. Nine years after the turn of the 20th century, a photographer named Edgar Casey stepped off a Pullman onto a crowded passenger platform in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Edgar might normally have paused to greet acquaintances at the station or warm himself beside the coal stove in the ticket office, but he had more pressing business on that cold February night. He pulled up the collar on his thin cotton jacket and ventured into the downpour to meet a waiting carriage. The driver, Lynn Evans, quickly ushered Edgar inside his cab. As chief ticket agent and superintendent at the Hopkinsville Depot, Lynn was the natural choice to be on the lookout for his brother-in-law's arrival on the northbound local. Knowing the urgency of Casey's visit, Lynn likely reached for the horse's reins the moment the tall, lanky photographer emerged from the locomotive. Framed in the yellow halo of light from the overhead oil lamps on East 9th Street, Edgar looked too young to be a church deacon or the owner of one of Kentucky's most respected photographic studios. His shy, pensive smile and clean-shaven face gave him the youthful appearance of a college sophomore coming home for the holidays. His tousled brown hair was cut short, accentuating his high forehead, deep-set blue-gray eyes, and receding chin. His large feet and hands seemed better suited to an awkward boy on the verge of manhood than a 32-year-old husband and father. A closer look at Casey revealed the truth of his age and occupation. Having spent much of the last decade in a darkroom, his complexion was pale, and his fingers were stained brown from the chemicals he routinely handled. The acrid odor of those chemicals still clung to his clothes as Edgar knocked the mud from his shoes and climbed into the carriage for the 1.25-mile trip through Hopkinsville to a house known to Edgar and Lynn as The Hill. The journey was familiar territory for both men. Edgar had traveled it many times on foot and by bicycle during his courtship with Lynn's sister, Gertrude. And though he now had the luxury of taking a horse and carriage, Casey knew the unpaved streets of the city as intimately as he knew the darkroom in his photographic studio in Bowling Green, Kentucky. The house called The Hill sat on a high promontory a few hundred feet within the city limits. It was a single-story, four-bedroom home of classic antebellum design, dominated by four white Doric columns. The front of the house had a large open veranda shaded by oak and maple trees. The home and its many outbuildings had been designed and constructed by Dr. Samuel Salter, Lynn and Gertrude's maternal grandfather, a respected civil engineer, an unlicensed physician, and one of the county's leading building contractors. It had been the late Salter's dream that The Hill would always be a safe haven for his family and their progeny. He had assembled an extensive library of technical and reference books, kept a full store of medical supplies in a large cedar chest in the dining room, and stored enough food in the root cellar and smokehouse to feed a family of eight for an entire year. It wasn't enough, however, that his family be materially independent. He wanted his three daughters and two sons to become free thinkers. He sent them all to college and urged them to read newspapers, attend rallies, and engage in intellectual discussion. Their opinion counted, no matter what political or social cause they chose to support. To Edgar Casey, who'd been born in a tiny frame cottage on a remote Christian County farm, who had ended his formal education at the age of 16, and whose mother and sisters didn't dare to express an opinion of their own, The Hill held an attraction that went beyond his love for Gertrude and his affection for Lynn Evans. The Hill was an intellectual hothouse that both stimulated and challenged his deeply felt notions of religion and spirituality. At The Hill, Edgar didn't feel the need to confine his creative interests to the darkroom or conform to the rules preached by the church elders. He could freely explore a part of himself that he had kept hidden from his pastor and from his clients at the photo studio. At the hill, he was free, as Lynn liked to say, to experiment. Lynn brought the horse to a halt, and Edgar walked up the muddy path to the veranda, where he was greeted by Hugh Evans, Lynn's older brother. The two briefly exchanged pleasantries before entering the parlor, where the rest of the family was gathered around the fireplace. Lynn's mother, Elizabeth, was there, along with her sisters, Kate and Carrie, and Carrie's husband, Dr. Thomas House. Everyone's attention was focused on Carrie and Thomas's infant son, Thomas House Jr., who lay on a pillow in his mother's lap. The infant had been suffering convulsions since his premature birth 3 months earlier. The convulsions had become so frequent that they now occurred every 20 minutes, leaving the helpless child too weak to nurse from his mother's bosom or to wrap his tiny hands around her fingers. Tommy House was on the verge of death from malnutrition and lack of sleep, a diagnosis confirmed by the child's father, a doctor, and by the family's two personal physicians, Dr. Jackson and Dr. Haggard. Although the three doctors disagreed about what treatment they should provide, all agreed that Thomas House Jr. had little or no chance of living through the night. They now turned to Edgar Casey, a photographer with an eighth-grade education and no medical training, to save little Tommy's life. Carrie wasn't sure Edgar could help her son, but she wanted him to try. In previous experiments, Casey had demonstrated a remarkable ability to put himself into a hypnotic trance and obtain medical and other information beyond the grasp of ordinary people. Even as a child, Edgar only had to close his eyes to locate a lost ring or pocket watch. He could read a deck of playing cards that were face down on a table, or recite the contents of a closed book or sealed envelope. By merely thinking about someone, he could wake the person up from a deep sleep and induce him or her to make a telephone call or write a letter. In the case of young children, he could hold them in a particular pose long enough to have their portraits taken. He had solved a murder, found missing persons, diagnosed illnesses and disease, and recommended cures. He didn't use a crystal ball, playing cards, or a Ouija board. He needed only to close his eyes, as if putting himself to sleep. And after a short period of quiet and meditation, he was able to help any person who asked for it. The greater the person's need, and the more sincere their motivation, the more astonishing were the results. The mere arrival of Casey at the hill was enough to provoke Dr. Haggard to pack his bags and leave. Like many doctors in the area, he had heard accounts of Casey's alleged powers and wanted no part of his trickery. Dr. Jackson shared his colleague's skepticism, but as the family's longtime physician, he had seen Casey do things that he could not readily explain. Dr. House, Tommy's father, was also skeptical, but he also knew Casey too intimately to believe that trickery was involved. The Caseys were simple tobacco farmers from the rural hamlet of Beverly, and Edgar was the least educated and most unassuming of the lot. House had reluctantly agreed to call Edgar to the hill, only because House's headstrong wife, Carrie, had insisted he be consulted. Doctors House and Jackson accompanied Edgar into the master bedroom. Edgar laid down on the bed, feet together, hands across his chest, and stared at the ceiling. More than a minute passed. Edgar's breathing deepened, and his eyes closed. Dr. House said, "You have before you the body of Thomas House, Jr. of Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Diagnose his illness and recommend a cure." By all appearances, Edgar was fast asleep, but Dr. House knew better. He had once seen the young photographer go into a trance so deep that fellow physicians thought he was in a coma. When one of House's colleagues had jabbed the blade of a knife under one of Casey's fingernails, he had not even flinched. And yet, the sleeping Casey could answer questions as if he were wide awake. Casey began to speak. At first his words were garbled, almost a hum, and then his voice cleared, and his words became easy to understand. "Yes," he said, "we have the body and mind of Thomas House, Jr. here." Casey proceeded to report the infant's temperature, blood pressure, and other physical and anatomical details of his body. He appeared to have the ability to see right into his patient's body to examine each organ, blood vessel, and artery with microscopic precision, even though the patient was cradled in his mother's arms in the next room. Doctors House and Jackson listened intently as Casey described an epileptic condition that had caused severe infantile spasms, nausea, and vomiting, evidently the outcome of the child's premature birth. Casey prescribed a measured dose of belladonna, administered orally, to be followed by wrapping the infant in a steaming hot poultice made from the bark of a peach tree. Casey ended the trance session by stating, "We are through for the present." House instructed the sleeping Casey to regain consciousness. Casey awoke, only to find himself alone in the bedroom. In the 2 or 3 minutes it took him to open his eyes and stretch his arms, the two doctors, deep in discussion and agitated by what he had said, left the room and returned to the parlor. As unbelievable as the source of the information was, House and Jackson both agreed that the diagnosis sounded perfectly reasonable. It was the recommended cure that upset them. The sleeping Casey had prescribed an unusually high dose of a toxic form of deadly nightshade. Even if the peach tree poultice could somehow leach the poison out of the infant's system, administering such a large dose of belladonna to a child as small and weak as Thomas House Jr. was tantamount to murder. Edgar couldn't contribute to the discussion taking place. He had never been able to remember anything he had said or heard in a trance state, and had little more than a rudimentary knowledge of medicine in his waking state. Even so, he grew more and more concerned as he listened to the doctor's debate. Until now, his sessions had been an experiment, a way of seeing if his abilities could help people. He now had to face the grim reality that something he had said in a trance might result in the death of a family member. It was the child's mother who made the decision to administer the drug. Having seen Casey work miracles in his sleep, she believed that a heavenly spirit spoke through him when he was in a trance. If Edgar Casey said that she had to poison her son in order to save his life, then that was what she was going to do. At his wife's insistence, and despite his very great reservations, Dr. House ultimately agreed to prepare the belladonna. He justified the decision by saying that his son would surely die anyway if nothing else were done. He and Dr. Jackson might be able to prolong the infant's life by a few hours, but they were powerless to keep him alive through the night. At the very worst, giving little Tommy belladonna would put the child out of his misery. He dissolved the white powder into a spoonful of water, and Carrie forced her son to swallow it. Edgar didn't join the others in the parlor to see what would happen, because, as he later said, he couldn't stand the thought of seeing Tommy House die in his mother's arms. Medical records do not exist to describe the child's physiological reaction to the belladonna, or to the steaming hot towels dipped in peach tree solution in which the naked child was immediately wrapped. All that is known is that the crying stopped as soon as the mother spooned the poison into her child's mouth, and that he fell into his first deep and uninterrupted sleep since birth. Thomas House Jr. awoke hours later, drenched in sweat and breathing steadily. He was never to have a convulsion again. No one at the Hill that night knew who or what had intervened to save the child's life. They knew only that their lives, like that of little Tommy House, had been irrevocably changed. What they had experienced could neither be ignored nor denied. Edgar Casey had saved the child's life. Dr. House had witnessed something that would make it impossible for him to return to the medical profession as he knew it. 20 years later, he would close his practice and dedicate the remainder of his career to operating a hospital devoted to Edgar Casey and his healing arts in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Carrie House would become the Casey Hospital's supervising nurse and an outspoken proponent of the divine message that she believed was being communicated through Edgar. Thomas House Jr. would grow up and spend his adult life designing and building innovative medical technology based on Casey's trance readings. Edgar Casey also had undergone a change. He had once again proven to himself that good might come from his special talents. He had taken one of his first apprehensive and faltering steps away from the refuge of his darkroom and closer to the moment that he would, as he later said, step out into the light, and turn himself over to what became known simply as the work. In the years ahead, the work became such an integral part of Edgar Cayce's life that it was impossible to separate the man from his trance-induced communications. There were times when the readings threatened to tear his family apart, and times when they were all that held it together. Edgar Cayce would be catapulted to national prominence on the front page of the New York Times, and then vilified by the Chicago Examiner. He would be championed as a savior, and then reviled as an agent of the devil. But he would continue giving readings, twice a day, nearly every day, on topics as diverse as cures for breast cancer and arthritis, to the design of the universe and the purpose of man's existence on Earth. During his 43-year career, which ended on September 17, 1944, 3 months before his death, Edgar Cayce gave 14,145 fully documented readings for 5,744 people. Transcripts of these readings and the approximately 170,000 pages of correspondence, diaries, medical reports, and notes documenting the work comprise what is the most unusual and voluminous archive that has ever existed on a practicing psychic. Despite the overwhelming success of his medical readings, and despite the fact that the recipients of many of these readings were some of the richest and most influential people in the country, Edgar Cayce would spend much of his adult life living in poverty. He would move from home to home, constantly under threat of being persecuted for fortune-telling or practicing medicine without a license. At times, he didn't have enough money to feed his children and had to rely on his friends and in-laws to bail him out of debt or even jail. That Edgar Cayce persevered and continued giving readings for 4 decades was perhaps the greatest miracle of his life. And however inseparable the readings became from the man who gave them, it was not his trance communications that endeared him most to family and friends. A humble, kind, gentle, and affectionate man, Edgar preferred the company of children over and above his many rich and famous acquaintances. He invented card games to entertain visitors, bottled his own preserves, kept a dazzling garden, and maintained a lively correspondence with a vast array of people whom he had never met, from child prodigies and bank presidents to railway conductors and undertakers. Though demands on his time were so great that appointments sometimes had to be scheduled months in advance, he rarely missed his weekly Bible study class and never turned anyone away who was in genuine need. Like the engine on the locomotive that had brought him from Bowling Green to Hopkinsville to treat Thomas House, Jr., a powerful force drove Edgar out of what might otherwise have been a comfortable and ordinary existence as a church deacon, photographer, and husband. Exactly where he was going and what he would find when he arrived were questions he hadn't yet answered on that cold February night, nor had he, in fact, even begun to ask them. That his journey would be helpful to others was not in doubt. Edgar's father, Leslie Burr Cayce, was the second-born son of Thomas Jefferson Cayce, a successful tobacco farmer in Christian County, Kentucky. On June 10, 1874, Leslie married Carrie Elizabeth Major, the youngest daughter of Tom's neighbor, Uriah L. Major. Leslie was not yet 20, and Carrie was barely 17. By all accounts, Tom Cayce and the rest of the Cayce clan considered Leslie's choice to be a good one, for she was in line to inherit a few hundred acres of her father's prosperous farm. The Major family may not have viewed the union quite as favorably as the Cayces. Leslie was not a good farmer, and was generally considered to be a spendthrift and a playboy. As best as can be inferred from the historical record, Carrie must have been swept off her feet by her fast-talking, easy-living suitor. The joy of their union was short-lived. Leslie spent much of his time away from home, presumably chasing other women and get-rich-quick schemes. Debts quickly piled up. There is no doubt that Leslie was a poor farmer. Repeated attempts to farm the 166 acres that Carrie inherited from her father proved futile, and the property was turned over to creditors soon after the birth of their first child. The reason offered by the Cayce family for Leslie's failure as a farmer was not his inability to raise crops, but rather an obsessive fear of snakes, dating back to childhood. According to his brothers, snakes were strangely attracted to Leslie. If he put his hat down on the ground, a snake would crawl into it or curl around the crown. If he stood still long enough, they wrapped themselves around his ankles or crawled up a pant leg. They apparently never harmed him. They just liked to be near him. Leslie always said that this vexing attraction of snakes greatly contributed to his desire to drink. Upon encountering a snake, he was said to take a shot of whiskey to calm his nerves. But Leslie sometimes let the bottle take control of him. When drunk, he was angry and belligerent, and sometimes took a whip to his children. The most notable incident involving his drinking occurred on December 24, 1875, the night his and Carrie's first child, Layla Beverly Casey, was born and died. No specific details of what happened on that Christmas Eve night exist, except for a reference in a letter which Edgar would write years later to an old family friend. In it, Edgar said that Leslie got mad drunk and stormed out of the house. The next morning, the child was found dead in her crib. Family members have long alluded to a connection between his drinking and the child's death, but no evidence exists to support or deny such a claim. Leslie's brothers often referred to Leslie in their correspondence as selfish and self-centered, and took him aside for heart-to-heart talks. It was they who convinced him to lease the Beverly store, located in a quarter-mile-long settlement of homes and small businesses. Leslie traded what remained of his wife's inheritance for dry goods and other inventory. Despite the fact that the store didn't do very well under Leslie's management, he clearly took more pleasure and pride in it than he had in farming. Leslie's duties not only included managing the store and its merchandise, but also being postmaster and justice of the peace, which is how he came to be known as Squire Casey. Edgar Jr., named after his father's older brother, was born on Sunday, March 18, 1877, 14 months after the death of his sister Layla. He was called Edgar Jr. not because he was technically a junior, but to distinguish him from his uncle Edgar, who was a regular visitor to the house. Carrie would subsequently give birth to five more children: Annie, Thomas, Ola, Mary, and Sarah. In 1880, when Edgar was 3 years old, he fell headfirst off a fence post onto a board with a nail protruding out of it. The nail went so deeply into his head that it reportedly punctured his cranium and entered his brain cavity. Leslie, who had seen the accident happen, immediately ran to him and removed the nail. After the initial trauma of the fall, Edgar appeared to be perfectly fine. Turpentine was poured into the open wound, the head was bandaged, and the child eventually resumed his normal play. The degree to which this injury may have left lasting physiological damage or altered Edgar's normal brain development is not known. It must be pointed out, however, that other psychics attributed the development of their psychic abilities to similar blows they suffered to the head, which they believe stimulated their pineal or pituitary glands. Little or nothing is said about this incident by those who knew or wrote about Edgar in his later years, perhaps because Casey himself believed that his gifts were given him from God and were not of physiological origin. As he grew older, Edgar often visited his father's store, where he quickly became familiar with the inventory and could, when asked, retrieve items for customers. When business was slow, Edgar was quite content to sit quietly among the barrels and boxes and listen to the men discuss politics and farming. He loved nothing better than to entertain himself in the vegetable garden behind the store. It was here that he played with what he described as the little folk. His parents thought of them as imaginary playmates, but they were intensely real to little Edgar. In fact, they would remain a part of his life for decades to come. In a trance reading conducted 40 years later, Edgar suggested that he had indeed been visited by spirit entities, who at the time appeared in a form that would not frighten or threaten him. Their purpose, according to this reading, was to prepare him for the trials and tribulations to come, and many of these entities, if not all, were alleged to have been later reincarnated as people who became closely associated with the work. All Leslie and Carrie knew about the little folk was what Edgar told them about the games they played in the vegetable garden. There were never more than 7 or 8 of them, boys and girls, all about his own age. They had names, personal backgrounds, and distinct personalities. Leslie and his customers at the Beverly store often remarked about the sophistication of Edgar's imagination. His make-believe friends weren't Kentucky farm children. They came from places that people in Beverly didn't talk about, let alone visit, such as Egypt and Persia. Leslie and Carrie fully believed that their son's imaginary playmates would go away when his father gave up the Beverly store and the family moved. Leslie decided to try his luck farming again, and in 1880 he sold the store and moved into the Benjamin Thompson house, which was just a short walk from the home of Tom and Sarah Casey, Edgar's grandparents. Tom Casey and his grandson Edgar were, as old family friends would later contend, cut from the same tree. Edgar often napped in Tom's arms, and was never happier than when he was wrapped in Tom's long coat. In addition to teaching Edgar to fish and ride horseback, Tom helped Edgar build playhouses out of the tall grass and brush that grew along the banks of the Little River. Their favorite place was the barn, where Tom cured tobacco. During one of their many outings together, Tom Casey had a terrible accident. It is not known whether Tom had been drinking or not, although it has long been rumored that he had. The date was June 8, 1881. Edgar, just 4 years old, was riding behind Tom on a favorite mare. They stopped to water the horse at the pond, and Tom let Edgar down to catch minnows, his favorite pastime. As the story goes, Tom's horse was startled by what may have been a water moccasin. The horse bolted, plunged into the water, and swam to the other side. Tom managed to remain in his saddle. The horse, reaching the other side of the pond, tried to jump a fence, failed, and then turned back. At that point, the horse stumbled, throwing Tom into the water. Edgar, on the other side of the pond, looked on as the horse reared up and brought its hoofs down on Tom's chest. A physician who lived nearby was called for help, but Tom was surely dead before they were able to pull him out of the water. Tom had either been knocked unconscious and drowned, or had died from having his chest crushed under the horse's hoofs. Despite the close relationship that had developed between Edgar and his grandfather, Edgar seemed less perturbed by the tragedy than might have been expected. This could be attributed to his youth, but it was also true that even as a young child, Edgar's perception of his grandfather's death wasn't the same as it was for other family members. Not long after the funeral, Edgar's parents found him standing in the tobacco barn, conversing with his deceased grandfather. It must have been quite a relief to Edgar's parents when their son made friends with a neighborhood girl, little Hallie Shea, who was a year older than Edgar. She was the daughter of Hallie and Barney Shea, from whom Leslie had taken over the Beverly store. Petite, dark-haired Hallie was called Little Anna to differentiate her from her mother. Edgar and Little Anna became inseparable. They would play in the pasture behind the Liberty Church or along the banks of the Little River. Most important to Edgar, the little folk liked Anna as much as he did. Edgar's parents described the 18 months he spent with little Anna as the happiest of his childhood. Unfortunately, their relationship ended all too quickly. In December 1882, Edgar's father uprooted the family once again, the result of a poor tobacco harvest, and over the next 8 months they moved 3 times. Little Anna later died of pneumonia in January 1892. Her father, Barney Shea, died a day later from pneumonia contracted while nursing her. Like Edgar's dead grandfather, little Anna would reappear in Edgar's life, but not for many years to come, and not as the delicate brown-haired young girl with whom he had explored Little River. Anna's death touched Edgar in many ways that his parents could only speculate, for it coincided with the disappearance of the little folk. Though Edgar would continue to build special places in the woods where he could be alone, his spirit companions stopped visiting him. And although Edgar returned to the old tobacco barn many times, his grandfather no longer appeared in the eaves. Tom Casey's appearance in the barn would become no more than a distant memory of Edgar's childhood. There is no record of whether or not Edgar's parents were aware of the loneliness that engulfed their son during the difficult years of his childhood. Perhaps the first time they would have sensed that something was wrong was when he enrolled in the Beverly School in the fall of 1883 at the age of 6. Edgar was unable to concentrate on anything for more than a few minutes at a time, and developed a reputation as being strange. The situation didn't improve when the Beverly School closed and the Beverly Academy opened its doors near the Beverly store. Edgar's reputation had preceded him. Everyone in the class had heard stories about him talking to ghosts. The fact that Edgar had no apparent interest in playing baseball, shooting marbles, or any of the other popular school games aggravated an already tense situation. Reading was the only subject that interested him. This was triggered by a conversation that Edgar had once had with a black woodcutter known as Crazy Bill, who lived on his grandfather's old farm. Edgar happened to talk to Bill on the road on his way home from school one day when Bill was removing a tree that had fallen across the road. "I'm feeling as strong as Samson," Bill said as he wielded his axe. Edgar didn't know who Samson was, so Bill proceeded to recount the Old Testament story of Samson. No sooner had Edgar arrived home than he wanted to know all about the Bible, the people in it, and what went on in church where people read it. The family didn't have a Bible at the time, nor did his parents attend church regularly, though Leslie, in later years, told journalists that he and his family had come from a long line of churchgoers. The truth is that Edgar's immediate family didn't start attending services regularly until late 1886, when their 9-year-old son unrelentingly pestered them to take him. Edgar also hounded his father to get him a Bible. Leslie stopped at the Hopper bookstore on his next trip into Hopkinsville and told its owner, Elijah Hopper, that his adolescent son wanted a Bible more than anything else. Impressed, the elderly Hopper presented Leslie with a Bible for Edgar. For the rest of Edgar's life, a Bible was seldom out of his reach. A painful accident that occurred on January 9, 1888, would ultimately allow him to devote many hours to his Bible study. While walking in the woods, Edgar tripped and fell onto the sharp end of a stick. The point pierced his trousers and went right through one of his testicles. He developed an infection that spread throughout his groin area. Excused from chores and school, he spent much of that entire year in bed, alternately suffering from chills and fever and reading his Bible. By the time he had returned to his daily routine of farm chores, he had read the Old and New Testament 3 times in their entirety. Edgar's interest in the Bible naturally led him to take a more active role in the Liberty Church, which he began attending the first Sunday in January 1887. During the next 8 years, Edgar would miss only 2 services. Though it was not unusual for a 10-year-old to join the church, it was quite extraordinary for a child of that age to take such a keen interest in issues of doctrine and church management as Edgar did. He eagerly sat through the 2-hour services, attended Sunday school, adult Bible study, and the meetings of the church elders. There, he surprised the adults with his ability to quote long passages and interpret Scripture. Edgar was eventually appointed the church sexton, a position that had never before or since been held by a child. Whenever the church officers got together, it was usually Edgar who initiated Bible discussions. During one meeting, he heard a church elder declare that he had read the Bible from cover to cover 10 times. Edgar determined that he would read it through once for each year of his life. Edgar's enthusiasm became more acute as his knowledge of the Bible increased. With this increase in knowledge came ever greater curiosity and more difficult questions, which were not easily answered by the church elders. The most pressing question that occupied his interest concerned prayer. Edgar couldn't understand how a person could call himself a true disciple of the Lord if he talked and talked to God and he didn't answer. Edgar believed God would and should answer anyone who sincerely asked something of him. It was this belief that undoubtedly led to what Edgar later described as the single most profound experience of his childhood, a visit by an angel. This incident occurred one evening in 1889. Edgar had spent a long day reading his Bible and asking himself how he could be of service to the Lord. He had eaten dinner and, as usual, went to bed after helping his mother with the chores. His sisters were fast asleep in beds adjacent to his own, when he suddenly awoke in the night and perceived what he described as a powerful light coming through the doorway. Edgar later wrote, "I felt as if I were being lifted up. A glorious light, as of the rising morning sun, seemed to fill the whole room, and a figure appeared at the foot of my bed, an angel, or what, I knew not. But gently, patiently, it said, 'Thy prayers are heard. You will have your wish. Remain faithful. Be true to yourself. Help the sick, the afflicted.'" Edgar slept very little that night. Once the vision had faded, he rushed outside to his favorite tree, knelt beside it, and thanked God for answering his prayers. In the morning, he awoke to find himself still sitting under the tree. Edgar felt a sudden sense of joy and release, as if the mysteries of his early childhood had come into sharp focus. It was at that moment that Edgar believed he had obtained his first true insight into the life that lay ahead of him. He would be doing God's work, though exactly what he was to do and how he was to prepare himself were questions he hadn't yet begun to address. The fact that Edgar had what was later perceived to be psychic talents was becoming more apparent to him with each new year. A highly reported example occurred in 1890 when he was at the Beverly Academy, and his uncle Lucien was his teacher. As part of his daily lessons, Lucien asked him to spell the word cabin. Edgar couldn't do it, and was asked to stay after school to write the word 500 times on the chalkboard. Leslie was furious. That evening, Leslie took the spelling book and sat down to help Edgar with his lesson. Edgar read the words in his McGuffey's reader, and then spelled them out loud. But when the book was taken from him, he was still unable to get the spelling right. Leslie became increasingly annoyed at his son's failure. Furious, he slapped Edgar two or three times with the back of his hand, then knocked him out of his chair. It was almost 11 o'clock at night. Edgar was tired. He wanted to cry. He told his father that if he had a few minutes to rest, he knew he could do better. Leslie, tired himself, agreed to a 5-minute recess. Edgar put the book down on the desk and lay his head down on it while his father went into the kitchen. When Leslie returned, Edgar told him he felt refreshed. Leslie put the first word to him, and Edgar spelled it correctly. He also correctly spelled the second word, then the third, and the fourth. Initially, his father was pleased that all his work had apparently paid off. But as Edgar proceeded to spell the entire lesson correctly without so much as pausing, Leslie could only conclude that Edgar had cheated, or had pulled a practical joke at his expense, that he had known the lesson the entire time and had merely feigned ignorance. Leslie leafed through the speller, picking out words at random. Edgar knew them all. Before long, Edgar was telling his father where to find the words on the page. He said all he had to do was to close his eyes, and he could picture exactly what the page looked like. It seemed all Edgar had to do was place a book against his forehead, and he knew its contents perfectly. From that day on, Edgar advanced rapidly in school. Within a single year, 14-year-old Edgar Casey moved from the third grade to the sixth grade. One day, in an effort to fit in with the other boys in school, Edgar was participating in a ball game similar to Monkey in the Middle. When it was Edgar's turn to stand in the middle, he was struck in the lower part of his spine by the baseball. He blacked out and remained unconscious until the next morning, when he woke up in his bedroom and saw his family and Dr. Alexander Kenner standing over him. There are slight variations in the various accounts of what transpired between the time Edgar passed out and the moment he awoke in bed. The one thing shared by all accounts is that during his blackout, Edgar appeared to be conscious but acted strangely. It was as if he had suddenly become possessed by a demon. His sister Annie, who was on the playground when the accident happened, provided what appears to be the most reliable account. According to her, Edgar didn't seem to be physically hurt. After falling down, he got up, dusted himself off, and returned to the classroom. This was when he began to act queerly, as Annie described it. He upset the routine at school by making rude remarks and speaking out of turn. On his way home from school, he rolled on the ground, jumped in ditches, and stood in the middle of the road with his hands upraised to stop riders and carriages. His strange behavior continued through dinner, where he threw food at his sisters and laughed uproariously. Angry, Leslie sent him to bed. As soon as Edgar's head hit the pillow, he began to speak strangely. He talked about things he couldn't possibly have known. At some point in Edgar's rambling diatribe, he announced the outcome of the next presidential election, which was then in progress. "Hooray for Cleveland!" he shouted. Indeed, Cleveland was winning the election at approximately the time Edgar let out his cheer. There were no telephones or telegraphs that could have relayed the information to the Casey farm. Suddenly, Edgar became very earnest. He began to issue instructions to his father and mother to fix a poultice for the back of his head. Although the exact recipe was not put down on paper, all accounts agree that it consisted of cornmeal, onions, herbs, and other things readily available in the Casey pantry. "Do that, and I'll be all right," he told Leslie and Carrie. But his parents, fearful that this was some trick or work of the devil, didn't act. It was Sarah Casey, his grandmother, who collected the ingredients, prepared the poultice, and put it on the back of Edgar's head. Dr. Kenner and the Caseys' other neighbors were confident that Edgar had lost his mind. But the next morning, Edgar appeared to be fine. He climbed out of bed, dressed, and ate a large breakfast. "He cured himself," Leslie told neighbors. The fact that he was different than other children had always been a source of insecurity and irritation to Edgar Casey. As a teenager, it became an outright problem. This became clear during the summer after he turned 15 and fell in love with 16-year-old Bessie Kenner, the daughter of Dr. Alexander Kenner. Edgar had been secretly in love with Bessie for a year before he openly courted her at picnics and parties. It took all of Edgar's courage to make his feelings clear to her during a church picnic held in the woods behind the Casey cottage. Bessie and Edgar wandered off together to the little glen where he liked to dream and read his Bible. He told her about the dreams he had for himself as an adult. It was no secret by now that Edgar wanted to be a preacher, to do God's work. He even went further to suggest that she could become his wife. Bessie laughed. She did like him, but her interest in him had been more curiosity than a love relationship. The fact that he wasn't right in the head, as her father put it, made marriage to him unthinkable. Edgar was shocked. Not only did she not share his love, she thought that he was unworthy of her. Upset, he visited Bessie's father, Dr. Kenner, to ask him if he truly believed that he had mental problems. Kenner didn't mince words. Indeed, he thought Edgar was unfit to be a husband and a father. Not only was there the question of whether or not he would be able to have children, the result of his testicles being injured in his youth, there was an even greater concern about his mental health. Deeply hurt and humiliated, Edgar could not stand the thought of returning to school to face Bessie. As Edgar would do many times in the years to come, he turned his back on a difficult and unpleasant situation. Despite his remarkable academic progress, he dropped out of school and took a job growing tobacco for his uncle Edgar. Young Edgar was determined to turn his back on what he had come to view as his childhood preoccupation with fairies, imps, and angels. He desired nothing less than to be normal. To him, this meant playing cards, dating girls, and drinking corn whiskey. The fact that these things didn't come naturally to him was not going to stop him. He intended to learn. Up until this time, Edgar's only vice had been smoking a pipe, which he had begun to do when he was about 14. Now he began rolling his own cigarettes, too. During one of Edgar's forays into Hopkinsville, he entered a saloon and asked for a drink. The bartender recognized him from church and refused to serve him. "I'll not be responsible for giving a boy like you your first drink," the bartender told him. Edgar's now bedridden grandmother, Sarah, had started saying prayers on Edgar's behalf. She sent for him on June 8, 1893, the anniversary of her husband's death. Edgar dutifully came. He remembered the visit with great detail, for it was the day, at age 16, he decided not to be someone he wasn't, and to move out of his parents' home and live with his grandmother. He broke off the associations he had been trying to cultivate at dance halls and saloons, returned to reading his Bible, and opened his heart and mind to whatever it was that the good Lord had in store for him. In Edgar's later correspondence, it is clear that the conversations he had with his grandmother went a long way toward helping him accept the fact that he would never be able to live the kind of life that others would expect of him. Edgar and his grandmother discussed Edgar's dream of becoming a pastor, but mostly they talked about the special gifts that Sarah believed the Lord had bestowed on him. "Don't be afraid of it, and don't misuse it," she told him. Edgar was alone with her, holding her hand, when she died a month later. The last thing she said to him was that everything was all right. "I see your grandfather coming for me," she said. Although Edgar, by now, could no longer see his grandfather, he believed that, indeed, Tom Casey had come for her. This is the end of Side 1. Please fast forward and turn over the tape for proper cueing of Side 2.